and welcome to Avachine Podcast. In this podcast, we welcome guests who are waging a struggle. My name is Frederike Gerink. I'm a journalist who writes and speaks about power structures and those who want to tear them down. This podcast is powered by Media News, which you can visit at medianews.net. Let me explain why this podcast is called Avachine, meaning blue water. Avachine is a region in the mountains of Kurdistan, where the river by the same name has its source. The Avachine is clear, blue and sparkling, and an inspiration in the Kurdish struggle for freedom. In this episode, I'm honored to welcome Rahila Gupta as my guest. Rahila lives in London. She is a writer and an activist who has been a member of the Southall Black Sisters in London since the 1980s, a group that struggles against gender-related violence against women. Rahila is also a patron of the Peace in Kurdistan campaign. Welcome as my guest, Rahila.
Hello.
My first question to you is, what is the source of your struggle?
Thank you for inviting me to be part of this podcast. So in terms of the origins, if you like, it really goes back to the fact that I was born in a communist household. And so the idea of struggling to change the status quo was something, I suppose, that came to me via my mother's milk. And I wasn't actually, strangely enough, very political until I came to England and faced a certain amount of racism.
Where were you born?
I was born in England, actually, but I lived most of my life in India. So I was sent off at the age of 5 months back to India because I was an unplanned baby. And then I came back at the age of 19 to study further in this country. And I think it was the experience of racism that really politicized me. And then through I came into contact with Black feminism in this country and realized that actually the struggles against race and against racism, rather, and against sexism were really interconnected, and that the position of Black women in British society was a particularly difficult one. They were at the bottom of this society. And so I became active in the struggles.
And the Southall Black Sisters, they highlight and challenge gender-related violence against women and empowers women to gain more control over their lives, focused on the needs of Asian and African Caribbean women. Can you explain a little bit about how you already mentioned the interconnectedness? Can you explain that a little bit more and why these groups are, like you said, like at the bottom of society?
So I need to give you a little bit of the history of Southall Black Sisters. It was set up in 1979, and the women who formed the original Southall Black Sisters had been active in anti-racist struggles in Southall, in the community. In 1979, there was in the local town hall in Southall, there was a meeting that was held by the National Front, which was a fascist white English group. And although the community said that this was a provocation and that they should not be allowed to meet there, the local council gave them permission. So when the community protested outside the town hall, and it was in very, very large numbers, the police, instead of protecting the community, were protecting the National Front against the community. And they were on horseback and they charged against the young men who were there. And also one activist, Blair Peach, who came to support the movement, was killed by the police. So these young men were picked up and criminalized for, you know, breach of the peace, for disorder, etc. And the women who were also part of the demonstration.
One second.
Yeah, sorry, I'm going to shut my windows, I think. Did you hear the motorcycle? Yeah.
Oh, so, was that a motorcycle?
Yeah, it was outside my my windows. Okay, sorry about that. Oh, you have to do some editing, I'm afraid.
No, if it's a motorcycle, it's okay, because I thought it was a technical failure somehow, you know? But okay. If it's a motorcycle, it's, you know, fine. Okay. I'll cut
so
it out.
Should I just continue from where I was, or do you want me to go back a bit? Do you want to start?
Can you go back a little bit, like to the horses, and they charged the people? They didn't protect the people, but yeah.
So there were a lot of young men who were picked up by the police for things like disorder, breach of the peace, etc., purely for, you know, protesting. And they were charged, and the anti-racist group, which included both men and women, supported these young men in terms of their trials and in terms of trying to get them released. In this process, the women recognized two things. One was that they faced a fair amount of sexism from their male comrades, including some degree of sexual harassment as well. And at the same time, as this famous meeting took place in the town hall, there two other things happened. One was that a woman was, and her four daughters were burnt down in their homes by a violent husband. And so the women said to their male comrades that we really ought to be campaigning about this and, you know, and taking this up as an issue. The men felt that this would be exposing the underbelly of our community to the host society. Therefore, we mustn't talk about it. This guy was an alcoholic. So it was nothing. It was a one-off. It, you know, there was no issue really to be campaigned around as such. That was one thing. The other thing was that in the same year, and I still feel a little bit of a shiver when I talk about this because I can't believe it happened in my own lifetime, but the British state, in order to clamp down on immigration, was testing Indian women's virginity to make sure that they were coming to this country as part of a genuine marriage. So they were taking the Asian community's patriarchal values on board and then saying, well, in an Indian society or in an Asian society, a woman who comes for an arranged marriage will be a virgin. If she is not a virgin, then she is coming here for the primary purposes of immigration and not marriage. So the community rose up against it, including the women who went on to form South Hall Black Sisters. By then, they had already formed into a group called South Hall Black Sisters. So these were the two kind of starting points. And really, what the story about the National Front and the South Hall Town Hall in that meeting tells us is about having to face in two directions. That you have to face down the racism of the so-called host community. And the way we did that was partly to say that violence against women doesn't just happen in Asian communities, it happens across the board, in all communities, all classes, and so on, as a way of minimizing any possible argument that Asian or Black men were more savage or more, you know, backward, to try and deal with that argument on one hand. And then on the other hand, to be able to also fight racism that we found within the white feminist movement as well. So we were facing many different directions and trying to progress our own cause. As women facing oppression within our own communities, at the same time doing it in a way that would not attract racist commentary or racist reactions. So that was the way in which the intersection worked. And of course, there was a third intersection, which was that of class, because the women who came to us would only came to us because they were poor, they were not able to deal with the issues that they faced without the assistance of a group like ours. So that is really how it started. And that is an issue that has continued, interestingly, in many different ways, because whilst the idea of domestic violence within our community has been taken up also now by the men, they no longer call us homebreakers, which is what they used to call us before. They've acknowledged that. But what we find, for example, this same difficulty in dealing with issues has come up when we look at religious fundamentalism, because we have tried to deal with the issue of religious fundamentalism by saying that all religions in their religious extremist forms are actually dangerous for women, have values that do not support women's liberation, whether it's in the holy book or whether it's in the way it's practiced. But because we were in a political moment where we had the rise of pan-Islamism, the focus tended to be on Islamism, and the left in Britain had certainly were not able to pick up that nuanced position, because what they saw was there was a Muslim community which was under siege from a racist state, and therefore they would not even pick up on Islamic fundamentalism. So again, we were doing the two things. We were saying we absolutely oppose racism against the Muslim community in Britain, but at the same time, we have to look at religious fundamentalism. And if at the moment it is within Islam, then so be it. But we also will point to, you know, Modi's India and Hindu fundamentalism there, or Israel and Zionism and all the other parts of the world. So South of Black Sisters also in 1989 set up a group called Women Against Fundamentalism. And it was the coming together of women across all religious backgrounds, including Catholic and Christian women who fought against Christian evangelical far-right movement. Mm-hmm. So this has been our kind of trajectory, if you like.
It's very interesting indeed that you explain this happened in the late 70s, early 80s, but this intersectional analysis is still standing after all these decades. But maybe the methods with which you struggle have changed, or haven't they?
Yes, they have. I think it's partly to do with our success and partly to do with the fact that we are a long-standing, long-established group. So when we first started up, we were probably more given to protesting on the streets to have our voice heard. So we, for example, organized the first demonstration and march in Southall, which was a women-only march, in order to protest outside the home of a woman who had committed suicide, but she had been driven to suicide by violence from the father, the husband, and the father-in-law and the family of the husband. And we adopted the Indian women's tactics, which was that a lot of what goes on in our communities goes on against women in the name of honor and shame. So we would say, okay, so if that's what you do in the name of honor and shame, we are going to stand outside your house and we are going to say, was it suicide or was it murder? We are going to shame you in the eyes of the local community. So that was one of the first marches we organized. And we did quite a lot of that in the initial period. We still do that, but we don't do enough of it. And now what has happened is a lot of the levers of change take place either within the court system. So, for example, we might challenge a legal decision. So we might go to court for it. We had the case of a woman who was imprisoned for killing her husband. We got her released. We got the law not changed so much as reinterpreted so that it would help women in that same situation. And we also found that we were lobbying the government, we were lobbying the opposition, we were spending more time in the corridors of parliament So we'd moved from the streets to the courts, to the parliamentary corridors. But what we did was we retained our radical edge.
Yeah, so, that's the danger a little bit. I was going to ask, how do you feel about that change? But
well, just to give you, I don't know if there is time, but I'll give you a quick example of this. So one of our staff members was asked to join a committee on looking at how to deal with forced marriage. And it was made up of various parliamentary, the Lords and members of parliament and other activists. And she was in the meeting and they didn't agree with one. We were not happy with one of the recommendations, which was mediation in such situations. And we knew that mediation didn't work and was dangerous for women. And when she couldn't get the group to agree to that, we, the rest of Southall Black Sisters, were standing outside the building, the Home Office building, holding a demonstration. So she walked straight from that committee down onto the road and joined our demonstration saying, we do not agree with this. So that's a little bit of the kind of strategy that we have adopted.
Connecting the street to the corridors of courthouses and parliaments.
That's right.
Yeah, very good. And you told me, for around 6 months, you've been running the Southall Black Sisters. And you said that sometimes it's directly a matter of life and death. So it's also sometimes apparently very personal on very individual cases. Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, sure. What we do is we obviously, a lot of our campaigns are aimed at political change, but the demands that we make politically arise out of our casework, arise out of the individual women that we see. They present with issues, and when we notice that there is a particular issue that affects more than one woman, we know that we don't have the capacity to deal with it case by case, woman by woman. What we need is a change in the law. And that a lot of it is connected to immigration law, which we have also been very active on. But the reason why I found it particularly difficult and stressful so is that, first of all, we do a kind of casework that isn't very common within the sector, partly because of funding, which is that we stay with a woman for as long as she needs us to stay with her. So as a result, our advocacy team, we are always understaffed because there are not enough women who can do this sort of work because of the burnout factor. They work very long hours. We see more women than we should be seeing. And therefore, the danger of one of those women slipping out of sight, you know, falling through the gaps in the net, could lead to that woman's death, could lead to her being killed by her violent partner. And that kind of stress when you are dealing with an organization and you're, you know, dealing with women's lives, is actually very, very stressful. And it's a real potential, real possibility. I myself, because I'm not a caseworker, but because we didn't have capacity, I took on one case because I thought it was really important. We were contacted by the police in London because a woman from Bangladesh, a British citizen, had been kidnapped by her husband and her 6 children, taken to Bangladesh in February, and she was being beaten and he was really violent towards her, and we had to find a way of helping her escape. And every day she or her sister, who was based in London, would say, we really feel that she might die, she might lose her life. So, you know, trying to find a way to get her to leave the country in good enough time is really scary. And that's what I mean. That's why it's so stressful. And I wasn't even doing casework.
And did you manage to get her back?
Yes, she came back last week.
So, yes. But this is how you also work very, like, you don't let women go as long as they need you. So that also means maybe if it's necessary, like daily visits or can you make it concrete? What do you do?
Well, so first of all, you know, if she's experiencing violence from her husband and she needs to leave, we have to ensure that she goes safely back to the house, say accompanied by the police, to pick up her belongings, maybe to pick up important paperwork like her passport, which will allow her to remain in this country. If she's got children, we need to arrange for schooling. We need to make sure that she has housing. We need to make sure that she's not in the local area where she was living with her husband, so that she has a degree of anonymity. Finding housing, finding benefits for and ensuring benefits for migrant women. One of our big issues is that they don't have a right to remain in this country unless they have gone through certain hoops. And if they've left their marriages before the probationary period of a marriage to a British spouse is over, they might find themselves without recourse, no recourse to public benefit. So that's a whole other issue in terms of fighting the case through the courts, finding a solicitor, finding counseling for the woman who will be traumatized. And so the counseling can go on for a few weeks, months. And even after that, she may not feel, you know, that she is independent enough. I mean, every effort is to make the woman independent, you know, to wean her off. So we also have a support group, which meets once a week, where women can come together, they find friendship, we do activities, it might be arts and crafts, it might be, you know, filming, camera work, whatever. We do various things in order to fill those hours. And we, in that process, we also talk about the politics of violence against women. We encourage them to come with us on demonstrations and campaigns. So, and some of those connections with those women will remain for their lifetime if they're interested, or they may move on. They may move on. So,
And after all these decades of activism with this group, what have you learned personally about waging a struggle?
I think the disappointing fact is that we, at an optimistic assessment of it, that we move two steps forward and one step back. When I'm feeling a bit more negative, I would reverse that and say that we move one step forward and two steps back.
Yeah.
The whole immigration situation environment in Britain has only become worse and worse and worse for the last 40 years that we've been around. And, you know, so we chip away and erode certain things about the legislation and find we can help a few women, but then the picture for the entire community gets worse and worse. So it's really it can be quite depressing. I think that's probably my biggest kind of lesson.
In the beginning, you were more hopeful, like we're going to struggle a couple of years and then this problem will be tackled. Yeah.
And also, I think I think my initial hope was much more revolutionary, much more radical, that we will, you know, overturn patriarchy, etc. And whilst the ideological framing remains radical, in practice, we have to recognize that we are reformists. And what we are doing is making a few changes to the law here and there, you know, to policy, to institutions, but actually we are not overturning anything.
And do you find that disappointing or?
Yes. I mean, yes, I think, you hold on to the fact that even the few changes that you've made might have helped, you know, 100 women, 1,000 women. It might not have helped them in any great way. They might still be trapped in patriarchal situations, but we've helped them leave a violent partner. We've helped them restart a life. So, you know, we've tried to draw attention to the dangers of religious fundamentalism or any of the campaigns that we've run. And that's, I suppose, you have to find, as human beings, we look for the positive in the things that we do. Otherwise, our lives would be entirely meaningless.
But that's also maybe connecting a little bit to the international part of it, because we know each other. We met each other at the Kurdish conference in the European Parliament a couple of years back. And you were there because you're a patron of the Peace for Kurdistan campaign. And also this podcast was also started because it's of course from Media News, which is from the Kurdish political movement in Europe. And they want to connect to other struggles in the world. So I said, okay, you can invite people to a podcast. They said, okay, do that. That's a nice idea. Why was it important for you to already be an activist in this group, which takes a lot of your time and energy, and also connect with the Kurdish struggle?
So I have to say that I came to the Kurdish struggle quite late. And it, I came to it because I was, I'd started a book project, a collaboration with Beatrix Campbell, a British journalist. And the provisional title of the book is Why Doesn't Patriarchy Die? And I came across Mehmet Aksoy at a conference talking about Rojava.
Mehmet Aksoy is, I know, but can you say who he is?
Yeah, so Mehmet Aksoy, well, I mean, you know, lifelong Kurdish activist, really inspirational figure, filmmaker, journalist. He ran the Kurdish Question website. And, you know, yeah, just a brilliant human being, actually. And he was speaking about this revolution in Rojava at a conference on democracy. I think Democracy Reimagined or something like that. And I couldn't quite believe it. I thought, what, in the Middle East, you know, in the area where we know that women have the, you know, the most difficult situations that they are facing. And when he talked about this, and he talked about the fact that, you know, they were doing a lot to defeat patriarchy, I thought, well, if I'm writing a book on why doesn't patriarchy die, then we need to see this place where this experiment, where patriarchy is on its knees, perhaps. And so I went to visit Rojava, and that was the beginning of my relationship, my connection with Rojava. And, you know, the interesting thing was that I sort of went with this feeling of, my God, this has happened so quickly. And what are the circumstances that can lead to a revolution like this? And all the activists I met in Rojava said, oh, no, we've been doing this for 40 years at least.
There's a big background to it. Yeah.
Yeah. And I said, but South All Black Sisters has been doing it for 40 years and we are nowhere near this revolutionary situation. So 40 years at one level doesn't seem a long time. You know, of course, at another level, it is a long time. It's a lifetime. But so it's still the question of what were the material circumstances which allowed for, you know, this revolution to be successful remained as an important question. And one that I set out to answer in the chapter that I wrote for this book. So really, that was my kind of connection with Kurdistan.
And what conclusion did you draw? Like, what circumstance was the most important, you think, to make that revolution happen that you don't have in London or in England?
I think the political vacuum in Syria at that particular time was a very big reason. But of course, I mean, it's trapped now within, you know, multinational powers all vying to get their hands on that area. So it's really treading a very, very difficult line between, you know, different interests that want to lay their hands on Rojava. But I think the other thing which really impressed me, and which I don't know whether we in the West are that dedicated to our politics, is the immersive nature of the political orientation or the political mobilization that was done. So, you know, the fact that comrades Hewal's went from home to home, spent all night there if necessary, talking to people, to ordinary people, you know, talking about their vision, talking about the history of Kyrgyzstan, talking about patriarchy, about the 5,000 history of patriarchy, 5,000 year history. So all of these things, this particular level of commitment, what if we were to set that up in our countries, you know, to go from home to home, to spend a day, days, whatever, talking to people. I think that that is a very big commitment. And I think that that could have been the thing that made such a big difference.
Yes. Yeah. Does it give you hope that it is possible to crush the patriarchy, or what else gives you hope?
No, I think I mean, my discovery of the Kurdish women's revolution has completely refreshed my whole kind of activism. You know, it has brought real hope. I felt so privileged to have gone there, to have seen it for myself. I felt like I'd missed all the other, I mean, before those revolutions soured, like I would hear talk of, you know, what went on in the Soviet Union when my parents were talking. And then when I grew up, there was Nicaragua, but I had young children, so I couldn't go to Nicaragua. I just felt I hope that the Rojava Revolution will continue to grow and grow and expand and develop and be replicated around the world. But, you know, I feel if it doesn't, I'm so glad that I was there and I saw for myself what is possible and, you know, and to try and replicate it elsewhere.
That's very beautiful. Thank you very much. Really nice how you connect everything.
Thank you. Thank you. Okay.
You've been listening to Avachin Podcast, powered by Media News. Your host was Frederike Geerdink. The music you heard was composed and performed by Ula Shishil. I would highly appreciate it if you shared this podcast on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, or wherever you are active online. Thank you in advance, and until the next episode of Avachin Podcast. Well, thank you very much. Really very nice. Perfect.
Yeah, good to talk to you.
Yes.
Good to talk to you.
Yeah. How long is it ago that we saw each other? I don't know. It was in 2000.
It was pre-pandemic. Pre-pandemic.
Very much pre-pandemic. Maybe
2018?
2014 or something.
No, definitely not 2014. Because I didn't go to Rojava till 2016.
Oh, okay. So I was already kicked out of Turkey at the time.
Yes,
so
you were. You have been.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if you're going to be at any, I don't know if the conference is going to happen in December or January. Actually, probably they will try. But we'll stay in touch anyway.
Yeah, we will stay in touch. Yeah, of course. Okay. All the best, Rike, and talk to you some other time.
Yes. And could you send some pictures? Did you see?
Oh, yeah, you did. Yes. Yes, I will do that. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I just don't know. I know that I have some very poor quality pictures of speaking in parliament on some Kurdish issue, but I don't know whether there's any backdrop that identifies that as a Kurdish event. I can't think of anything else. I mean,
or do you have a photo of you in Rojava?
Oh, yeah, I do have photos of me in Rojava. But then again,
Rojava is nice.
Yeah, but it's just me talking to people I've interviewed.
But that's nice.
Okay. Yeah. Hedia Yusuf. I think I've got a picture with Hedia Yusuf.
Okay.
Okay.
And And maybe something, some demonstration of the South All Black Sisters or, complicated. Anything you have,
Okay.
Don't go searching for us, is what I mean to say.
Okay. All right.
Okay.
Thanks. Okay. Bye.
Okay. Bye-bye. Bye.